This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, and the website is in the midst of an overhaul at the moment, which should be ready possibly by next episode, and I will let you know as soon as it is. Stay tuned. My guest today is Patty Johnson of Art F City, formerly Art Fag City, probably one of the two or three best known art websites, art blogs, non-print art publications out there. Really good to talk to her, and she has an awesome travel story that you will definitely want to hear. That's at the end of the conversation. I was recently in a Los Angeles gallery, ran into an artist, and he was there with one of the gallerists, gallery assistants, and he was asking after the podcast a bit, wanted to know what he should listen to. Of course, he should listen to all the recent, if not all the episodes. God forbid you should cherry pick. I was trying to think of one particular that I should recommend. The most recent one at that time that had come out was the recent one with Harag Vartanian of Hyperallergic, and neither he nor the gallerist had heard of neither him nor Hyperallergic. And so, come on, people. You don't have to read all of the art blogs. Obviously, there are way too many to keep track of at this point, but know the best known ones, the most traffic ones, Hyperallergic and the website of my guest, Patty Johnson, Art F City. Okay? Is that fair enough? So now you know, if you don't already. Before we get to that conversation, just want to tell you real quick about our affiliate partner, Made with Color at madewithcolor.com. Made with Color is designed specifically for artists and other creative types. It's a design-friendly website platform that's really easy to use. And if you use the code lowercase conversation, you will receive 29% off your first year of coverage. That's madewithcolor.com. Let's get to that conversation now with Patty Johnson. I hope you enjoy it, and I will talk to you on the back end. I have Patty Johnson with me on the line, and you are in Brooklyn, I take it?
I am in Brooklyn. I am speaking to you live from the Art F City basement. We call this the Blog Minds, where the magic happens.
I always love it when people can employ the phrase, where the magic happens. And I think it's a lot safer to do that when you're an entity like yours than when you're an artist, you know, because if you're an artist and you say, this is where the magic happens, you know, I think you're asking for trouble. What part of Brooklyn are you in?
Bed-Stuy.
Bed-Stuy. Was this entity originally called Art Fag City, and then it evolved into Art F City, essentially?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's correct. I named the blog Art Fag City originally because I started the blog to sort of cover the art in the city, and it seemed to me like that there was no greater density of art fans in the country than New York City. So when I use the word art fag, really what I was using the term to mean was art fan, sort of the same way you would use like opera queen or something like that.
Oh, interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Art Fag City was born out of that. And then, of course, we found that a lot of people really did not like the name.
Do you think people mistook it or misunderstood it?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I do think that for a lot of people, it didn't matter, you know, how I meant it. You know, it also had other connotations, and that was a problem for them. I wasn't too concerned about that, rightly or wrongly. Mm-hmm. Mostly I was concerned about things like, you know, we couldn't have a Facebook page. So, because Facebook didn't like the name and like kept pulling us off, you know, we couldn't like, you know, all our mail would go to spam.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we would get turned down for grants because, you know, somebody didn't understand the name. So when it starts costing you a lot of money,
yeah,
you know, and this is, I don't think that writing to begin with is an enterprise that most people enter anticipating to make buckets of money out of it, then you kind of have to consider how you're going to make a living.
Sure.
So that was one thing that just, I think, made the business a little bit more viable.
Well, you, speaking of grants, you guys, or you, maybe I should correct myself, won a Warhol grant. How many years ago was that? What year was that? 2011? 10?
No, I think it was 2008.
Oh, wow. Okay. So wasn't it called Art Fag City at that time?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so the Warhol Foundation was able to overlook that somehow.
Yes, but they don't represent all granting agencies. So
sure. Yeah.
But I was glad that they were able to do that, and that made a very big difference for me in terms of what I was able to do and how I was able to live.
Yeah. And when you started Art Fag City, as it was originally called, and you mentioned, you know, the terminology of sort of the art fag, like the opera queen, were you sort of trying to create a niche for yourself, or did you feel like you were addressing an absence that need to be filled?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but I think it's also important for me to make clear anyway that I didn't know anything, you know, like I really thought, like when I started the blog, I wasn't really reading criticism. And I thought, you know, oh, you know, I'll come out here and I'll tell it like it is. And I'll, you know, I'll write criticism that's clear and makes sense and all the rest, which I do think I did. But, you know, it's not like that didn't exist. It's just I wasn't aware of it because
right.
I never read those things. But, it also happened that I think there just was not a lot of art media online.
Yeah.
When I started in 2005. So, you know, the field was a lot smaller.
But did you willfully choose to not read, you know, the newspaper/magazine art criticism, or how did that work?
I guess everything is a willful decision. It was like, I guess I would say that I was not really aware of my own ignorance.
Right.
So, but I really believe that was important to me, because I think sometimes, you know, if I was aware of the sort of enormity of the task, I probably wouldn't have done it, you know, but I was just doing something that I thought was really fun, and I continue to do something that I think is really fun.
And maybe the sort of blissful ignorance, if you will permit that, that you came in with gave a lot of room for sort of breathing room to make it fun, and had that, and you may have attained that.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think, you know, you see that there's like, you see that in other artists and other writers too, at like certain points in their career. Like, for example, Nate Hill, on a panel that I attended this weekend at the Pratt Upload Digital Media Conference, he talked about his work as sort of not being afraid to be ignorant or uninformed, which he said was important because, you know, not because he didn't want to get better or correct his mistakes, but only that, like, it can sometimes empower people to be like, oh, you know, I can do this better, or I can do this. If this guy's doing this, then I can do that. And that, I think that kind of, it is a kind of self-education in public. It's very painful.
Yeah. How is it painful for you?
Well, for me anyway, I find it very difficult to be wrong in public.
Uh-huh.
And that's, like, it's definitely happened.
Does anything particular come to mind?
Okay, well, I guess kind of very early on, Eric Doringer had set up his kind of, he had like a table where he's selling knockoffs of Chelsea blue chip artists.
Right. And very small, very little paintings, for people who don't know his work. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tiny paintings, well, maybe not tiny, but little paintings that you could you know, just take home.
Right.
In lieu of not, you know, maybe if you can't afford a blue chip artist.
Right.
And so he had set up his table in front of Mike Weiss' gallery. Well, Mike Weiss was not particularly happy about this. And so he called the police on Eric Doringer. So this was 2005 this happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was upset about this. I thought, you know, this, clearly the people who are going in to buy from Mike Weiss are not the same people who are buying, you know, a little canvas. And even if they are, like, if the canvas costs like $200, like, for a collector, that's like buying a stick of gum.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they don't even, you know, you're not even going to think about it. So, you know, but it would make a very big difference for this particular artist. So I was very upset. And I wrote this headline. You know, I wrote this piece up, which had basically been sourced from, I think, another blogger who talked to Eric Doringer. And I wrote, you know, Mike Weiss, probably a Republican. And then I wrote this story up. Now, that's terrible for so many reasons.
Yeah.
It's hard to, you know, to even go into that. Like, it's name calling. It assumes that Republicans are terrible anyway. It has nothing to do with it, with the story. I never called Mike Weiss up.
Right.
To ask him about any of this stuff. So, like, even these sort of like basic reporting courtesies, I hadn't gotten around to doing, and I didn't do them because it didn't occur to me.
Right.
I was not a trained reporter.
Right.
And somebody called me out. Another blogger was like, you know, it's great to have all this activity, but when was the last time somebody did the basic journalistic courtesy of calling the gallerist up to get his side of the story?
Yeah.
And honestly, I was glad that somebody called me out.
Right.
But it felt terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, wow, how could I have done this? Like, this is so obvious.
It's good that you made that kind of oversight, to put it mildly, that early, though, in the history of the blog.
Well, sure. I mean, those kinds of oversights inevitably would have occurred very early in the blog, because I you know, I don't have any background. I didn't go to journalism school. I didn't take writing courses. Like, I have a degree in fine art, like a master's in like painting and sound art. So like, that was not my background at all. But that's not to say that errors on the blog don't occur or wouldn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, I think the New York Times, it was maybe 4 years ago now, they ran this article about like young rising stars and their greatest gaffes, like young rising blogger stars. And their
greatest gaffes. So you were included in the midst?
I wasn't in the midst, and I was like, thank God for that. I was so happy that like the art world was not enough on this, like, like on the Times radar to include me on that list.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about that list, though, was that it was 2 pages long, you know, and there were typically multiple gaffes, which is to say that if you're going to be writing in public, you will make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the game, and you can do everything you can to minimize them.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're going to happen. And I mean, we've seen that recently. I mean, Carol Vogel at the Times, I think, was recently called out for plagiarizing Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
oops.
Hopefully we don't make those types of oversights, but
that's a pretty rookie mistake.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes and no. I think that probably every writer will copy and paste a small amount of stuff from Wikipedia and then like rewrite it if they're like teaching themselves something in the course of an article.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for like a sentence to get stuck in there.
Yeah.
That you didn't think of. And I know this, not just because of my own editing work, but because my boyfriend, Steven, is a fact checker at the Times. And he finds that stuff all the time.
Well, that so is that is a great resource that you have there for your own agendas, right?
Well, he does in fact check me.
But still, his influence must be present, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's useful, definitely.
Yeah, good, good. So I want to go back, though, to the – I think it's good that you chose this early oversight example of Eric Doringer, the knockoff artist in front of the Mike Weiss Gallery, because it's kind of a sticking up for the little guy kind of tale, and I wonder how integral to your mission – to Art F City's mission that is. And just to set that up a little bit further, if you go to the, you have a section of your blog called We Went To, as in, you know, you went and visited galleries, neighborhoods, yeah, whatever. And so you have this one, we went to Petzl, We May Never Return. And then you had a piece on your homepage now that says, Patty Johnson has filed another ArtNet news review. It is titled Richard Prince Sucks. Click through to find out what she thinks of Richard Prince. So, you know, it's pretty easy to pick up this vibe of maybe trying to knock the big guys down, which I'm all for. And I just want to see, I know you're going to phrase it a different way, but I just wonder how integral to some of your mission that is.
Well, I don't think it's integral to our mission that we knock the big guys down.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is integral is that if somebody is making, you know, crap, that we think about it long enough to identify why it's not good. And, you know, if somebody is making crap and very visibly so,
right,
in the public eye,
okay,
that we take that down. And so somebody who's like working in their studio, mostly in isolation and shows occasionally, and is making not very good work, is probably not going to get stuck with a particularly harsh review from us, because they're not like influencing scads of people. It does worry me that Richard Prince might influence people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because I think that latest show at Gagosian is sexist. And I don't want to see more work like that. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's corrosive. I don't think it's good. You know, I don't think it's good art. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't think that it's good for women.
Right. There's another recent example of work that I feel like is not good for women. But maybe there's so many examples I can't put my finger on one. Okay, so let me see if I can come at it another way. So you basically, you don't really have that specific an agenda, but you just want to call it like you see it. Is that a better way of putting it?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, in our mission statement, we say that, you know, art and public art is, you know, is meaningless unless it's interrogated. So, you know, we're very invested in trying to sort of peel back the layers of an onion, you know, and identify meaning and how a work functions and that kind of thing. And, you know, we are very invested in supporting emerging artists.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in all the ways that term can be applied, both in terms of like young artists, but also in under-recognized mm-hmm. artists. You know, I think there's a lot of talent that goes unrecognized for reasons that is not entirely clear to me sometimes. You know, artists who I think...
Isn't it a sort of complex mix of networking, looks, you know, breeding, timing, kind of all of those things?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, and I think the longer you're here, the longer you see, like, artists' careers, like, sort of, you know, ebb and flow. You know, you see somebody who has a gallery for, like, 5-10 years, and then they lose the gallery, and they're, like, a free agent for a while. And, you know, so all of that affects an artist's career. But if somebody is making good work, we want to know about it, and we want to be talking about it. Because,
right.
I mean, at the end of the day, like, you know, I wrote that Richard Prince review, but I didn't feel great writing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of bothered me that I, you know, that this was even a task. Whereas when you see something you really like and you get, and you have the privilege of writing about it, you know, that feels significant.
Right. When did you use the word interrogated? What was the word you used before when you say...
Interrogate.
Yeah. So when you look at art and you... I think you said public art and art, to be relevant, essentially, is what you said, needs to be interrogated. And I just wonder, when you expose or critique or write a review of emerging art that's obviously in a different context than, you know, established blue chip art, are you interrogating it in a different way?
Well, I mean, I think I have a lot of the same rules that anybody else, most other critics have. So, like, you know, if the artist is sort of too young or something, like if I don't think the artist is going to benefit from the public exposure, then I probably wouldn't, and the public exposure would be negative, then I probably wouldn't write it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's one thing for me to, like, write a negative review of an artist that shows a pencil, you know, who's been making work for like 50 years versus like, you know, I can say a lot of negative things and it just doesn't, it's not going to affect, like it might slow their sales a little bit, but it's not going to kill their chance of making a living, you know, and I don't know necessarily that anything I wrote would have that effect on an emerging artist, but you know, maybe it's just better not to take that chance.
Do you think that you've been able to, not been able to, let me phrase that a different way. Do you think you've slowed any artist's sales through writing about it?
I have no idea, honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to presume.
I mean, those are the things that you don't, like, I know that I have increased sales by writing about art, so I would assume the same.
What's can you give us an example of that?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, there was something that, this is even sort of superfluous to all this. Like, I think I posted something on Instagram from a gallery visit from that I made to Canada, and they got a sale out of that.
Oh, okay.
So that wasn't even a review.
Right.
And that helped. But also I think, there was somebody who I had in my masthead. Now I don't even remember the guy's name, but he was showing at Pocket Utopia, and it was the first show that Pocket Utopia had. And he had taken a picture of his father, who was a disco DJ. I think he was an Armenian DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody read about that and bought the photograph. So,
right.
So, yeah, so it definitely happens.
So it's kind of a more of a press, a reporting, you know, exposure kind of element that helps give people more sales opportunities.
Oh, yeah.
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 I'm only...
It's not even necessarily
right.
Anything I write. I mean...
Yeah. I'm simply testing the comment that Jerry Saltz made in a conversation that I had with him not long ago, where he said... when we were talking about another Gagosian artist that he wrote about, that he said, I will not have any effect on this artist's sales, you know, whatsoever. It won't make any difference. So I was just basically applying that logic, and it sounds like you're more or less in agreement. So.
No, I mean, not entirely. I mean, Jerry Saltz is going to have effect on the sales, and, you know, I would have, to a lesser degree, some effect on the sales, but not a massive effect. Like, I'm not going to destroy anybody's career by any review I write, no matter how good or negative it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least not in the at the blue chip level.
Right. Well, I think this is a good time to be more retrospective for a moment. And you had mentioned that you are a painting and sound artist graduate. So you basically come out of the school of being an artist. And at what point did you sort of make the transition to being a writer?
2005. I mean, when I was doing the sound art, I was writing, but it was mostly fiction. And I think that fiction is maybe not for me, in the same way that art in the end was not for me. There's too many choices.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Whereas with art, like, you already have the thing, like, it's in front of you. All you have to do is respond.
Right. Right. Was it a momentous, conscientious choice where you said, okay, I'm going to, 2005, I'm going to start writing about art. This is my new thing.
No. No, I mean, I thought I was going to be an artist for a really long time, even while I was doing the blog. But, like, you know, it's just, as soon as I started doing the blog, I stopped making art.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You really... It was just, like, suddenly I had no time.
Yeah, you dug into it pretty deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about your notoriety, if for lack of a better word. I mean, gradually, I guess you've gotten more and more busy, and the blog has grown tremendously, and you've become sort of, you're now, I guess, a pundit and a judge for certain art contests and whatnot.
Right, right. The Art Prize.
Right.
Was, I guess, the most recent.
As a sort of a presence in the art world, do you feel too big sometimes, or do you always... Have you maintained, I guess, sort of a hard scrabble, sort of a, you know, an underdog kind of mentality? I think that's what I want to ask you.
Oh, that's really fascinating. No, I've never felt too big. I've only ever felt small.
Right. And I guess the art world can do that to people, right? Yeah, I said, I guess the art world can do that to people, it seems to me.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's not like I'm unaware that people know who I am and what I do, but, you know, I think sort of in the media landscape, within that landscape, I still run a relatively small blog.
Yeah.
Like, I am well known as a critic and as a pundit, but, you know, I still struggle to make ends meet. And I think until that changes, I don't know that I'm going to feel that different.
Mm, sure. Yeah. Can we talk sort of abstractly, you know, without getting to sort of very personal specifics, but I mean, you have received, you know, grants, you have advertising, you know, pretty large, well, of a decent amount, if not a large amount of advertising for the blog, but you also have now a pretty significantly sized staff or team. So there are a lot of what you do earn has to be spread around quite a bit. And, I don't know, do you live in Bed-Stuy as well as work there?
No, I live in Queens with my boyfriend.
Ah, okay. Got it.
But it's actually run at the office is run out of my old house.
Uh-huh.
So.
Right. Well, was that sort of a specific enough question, or do you want me to kind of put it more specifically? I don't know what to ask without being too sort of nosy, but I just want to maybe contextualize the fact that you have a very successful blog, but at the same time, you know, it's financially tight.
Yeah, it's financially tight. And I mean, I think that is the case for media in general, even the bigger publishers, like, often have to really tightly manage their money because staff does cost a lot. But, you know, I think one thing that's sort of immediately apparent is that AFC looks a lot larger than it is. You know, we're actually only a staff of three. We have only one of us is full time.
That's you.
So, yeah. So, you know, the auction that we're running now is something that we're doing, hopefully, to sort of bridge the gap that we have financially so that we can bring them on full time.
Okay. You want to talk about that auction a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the auction closes in 2 days.
Okay.
It's going to be done very soon.
We can talk about it retrospectively then.
Yeah. But, no, it took a lot of time to assemble that. That's now part of my job too. So
is it the auction made up of work donated to Art F City?
It is. Uh-huh. I mean, I think one thing that is kind of significant about understanding like what AFC is and who we serve is often through the types of like if you look at the revenue stream that we have, you'll see that some of our largest supporters are artists. So like the Joan Mitchell Foundation supports us. We have a large number of artists who donate to our benefit auction. And we're working right now to produce a calendar with an artist that will also be a suite of prints. And so those, I think that's not insignificant, that, you know, we found our support through the people we really serve. And it's fascinating to me that's, you know, where the bulk of this support comes from, especially because these artists are the recipients of like both positive and negative criticism, but they recognize the value in it.
Hmm. Well, it seems like this would be a good segue from the obviously being a media entity, if you will. I don't like to think of myself as the media, by the way, and maybe you sort of reluctantly take on that title, but there are obvious financial limitations, as we know, even though blogs, you know, are making print obsolete in a lot of ways. Blogs are not exactly filled with buckets of money. But what I want you to talk with me about is how you sort of see the financial inequities in not only the New York art community, but the New York maybe community at large. Isn't they're sort of a Bushwick community type of situation that you are involved with?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely involved in some of the housing issues that are affecting artists in New York. So one of the things that I've been working on is just trying to find solutions for artists who live here and, you know, are worried that they may not be able to afford to live here any longer. And that's, for anybody that kind of qualifies as middle class, like those are the people who are really, you know, feeling the pressure. And you see that quite a bit, actually, in the art world. We ran an interview with Jerry Thomas about a month ago, who is a recruiter and also a consultant for museums. And one of the things that she told me was that it was really the middle class within the art world that was suffering. So the directors who were making lots of money through commissions and things like that at galleries, they were doing fine, better than ever. And that the entry level positions, the pay had remained relatively stable, mm-hmm. but it was all the people in the middle that were really feeling the crunch.
Huh. So somewhere in between the entry level and the director.
Yeah. Those are people who are really suffering. I mean, you see it a lot in universities, for example. I mean, I think most university professors have not seen a raise in, like, you know, who knows how long. If anything, they've seen cuts. And, you know, while they're making a decent living, that, like, it's difficult, you know, with rising costs to not have your salary go up to meet that.
Right. And so the implication, just to be transparent, is that the entry level people, even if they are not, which I guess they overwhelmingly are, you know, young 20s people recently out of school who are living with, you know, anywhere from 2 to 12 roommates, you know, that they can get by because of those living situations. Is that the way you see it?
I mean, they can get by, but nobody can do that long term. I mean, I think what we're, you know, what I'm very concerned about is making sure that we have communities that, you know, aren't constantly forced to move and change and, like, are by nature a little bit more stable.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that artists benefit from having stable workspaces, and that does make for better art. And the people who are able to afford that right now are the artists who are lucky enough to have representation and strong sales. But without that, it's very difficult to live in this city in New York.
Yeah.
And I think that is a problem for New York artists in the long term. And you're seeing a lot of people move away.
Yep.
As a result. And I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... Sometimes I wrote an article about the New Orleans bounce scene recently, because Nikki Debbie had died. And, like, you know, when I look at that scene, and it, like, it's just like the creative energy just sort of seeds out of it. Like, it reminds me of what New York was like in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Or what I imagine it to be like. I didn't actually live here. But... But, you know, like what it looks like now is very different. I think that most artists are really stretched thin, and you can see that in their face, like and in their work, and like it's a problem.
Well, as part of the community involvement that you've had, are there some of the measures, you know, attempted to be taken, procuring buildings that will be dedicated artist studios, you know, with as like co-ops, you know, that kind of thing? What does it look like?
Well, people have different approaches. You know, there's a legislative approach. So ASAP is really pursuing that approach very, very aggressively. That's an artist collective. ASAP stands for Affordable Studio Artist Project.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been very diligently working with community members over the last year to try and figure out like what policy changes might benefit artists and then advocate for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a very grassroots kind of approach to things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a place like Placeholder is, you know, much more invested in, you know, doing fundraising to then purchase a building. So,
right.
So there are like, there's many different ways to skin this cat. I think, although by the same token, it is like, it is a difficult job. Like it's a very large one. And I don't even know if there's that much that can be done. I mean, New York City has a program called SpaceWorks, which sort of specializes in subleases. So they buy up, or they don't buy, they rent large spaces and then sublease it out at more affordable rates. But all of that, it's just a Band-Aid, you know. Their rents are still $2 per square foot, which is the outside limit of what artists can afford in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when those leases expire, the rent will just, if things continue as they are now, the rents are just going to be higher.
Right.
So to me, it's also, it's not just a Band-Aid, it's a Band-Aid on a gaping wound, you
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah.
It's not enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm working with a bunch of people, like in a lot of different groups to try to come up with solutions. Cause I'm just one of a very large and growing community that sees this as probably the biggest issue for artists living in New York right now.
Mm-hmm.
But what the solutions are, I just don't think anybody knows yet.
Yeah, and to just go back sort of backwards for a moment, just to give people more of a specific picture of what things are like. I mean, one way of describing it is that not too many years ago, Bushwick was the boonies of the New York City area in a sense. And then at some point over the 2000s, artists started moving into it. And now it's kind of like the way Williamsburg used to be, you know, in the 90s/early 2000s maybe. And so you have a bunch of people art and artists and art types living, you know, in group apartments, and maybe apartment loft type situations and that kind of thing. And so if somebody, tell me, correct me if I'm wrong, and tell, and so if people are, artists are moving to the city now and they want to be not too far out, they may look at a neighborhood like Bushwick and say, no, you know, this is too tight a market. So will they then, you know, move further out even into Brooklyn if there is such a thing, or they, Staten Island?
Yeah, I mean, there are artists living in Far Rockaway. Like, this is a,
right,
you know, up-and-coming community. Like, Far Rockaway is as far out there as you can get. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to be out there. You can move out, but, you know, at a certain point, you just sort of have to ask yourself, like, how much is of this hustle is worth it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been here for a very long time. Well, maybe not relative to some people, but for 13 years, like, I have a community here. You know, at this point, I feel like I, you know, if I don't do something to try and protect it, I will lose it.
Yeah. And fortunately, there are other like-minded people that you are talking with, if not actually trying to create action with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So, Patty, before we go, when you and I originally started communicating, I had told you about sort of an on and off again segment that I have on the show, loosely called "Don't Call Us, We'll Call You," but basically inspired by bad studio visits, and it, based on the work that you've done over the years, and in your response, it sounds like you've had a number of them. What are the top one or two that come to mind?
Well, I mean, I think the sort of, I don't know whether, I guess, like, the most, one of the most memorable kind of experiences that I've had as a critic, but not in a good way,
right,
happened when I was traveling. So I had a very kind of ambitious travel schedule. So I went to the Miami Art Fair, and then I went to New Orleans to Prospect One, and then I was flying to Portugal.
Wow.
So, and this was all in December. So you can imagine how big the suitcase is, because,
yeah,
I was coming, and I think I'd actually come from some other place. So I had to have clothes for, like, coldish weather. Then I had to have them for, like, warm weather. And there was a lot of sort of different occasions that I needed clothes for. And I was away for, like, 2.5-3 weeks. So it was quite a bit of time.
Yeah.
And when I was leaving New Orleans, there was some storm and I got delayed in the airport for hours. So when I finally took off from New Orleans, there was a stopover in Newark. Well, I couldn't catch my connecting flight.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to stay in the hotel overnight. And that was not ideal because my luggage had been stowed and I was not able to, like, change anything. So, like, I didn't, you know, I didn't have a change of clothes. I bought a toothbrush, like, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then I got back on the plane. I had a connection in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my connection, and the layover was like 5 hours because of this missed flight. And so anyway, I hear my name 5 hours later, I hear my name over the intercom, and I'm like, oh crap. And I missed my flight because there were two airplanes leaving at the same time for Lisbon out of the same airport, but in totally different wings. So I had to go and talk to an airport person about this. And luckily, one of the airport attendees had written an inaccurate gate on my ticket, even though I had made the mistake myself.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, I was presenting my case to this woman, and I had no money. I was totally broke at the time. I probably had, like, $12 in my account. And, like, I thought, you know, fuck this guy. Like, I was there to, like, see, you know, a specific artist who had flown me, and if I couldn't get the ticket rebooked, there'd be no way that I could even get there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, like, burst into tears, and the woman at the counter is like, what's wrong? And I was like, I haven't changed my clothes in 3 days. All right, like 2 days, you know?
Yeah.
I am tired. I have not slept properly. I have not been able to get to where I'm supposed to go. So the tears worked, and she not that I'd done that on purpose, but
right.
And she rebooked the ticket for me, and I got to Lisbon eventually, but I couldn't get in touch with the guy who was supposed to pick me up from the airport. His phone had gone dead, and I was waiting for my baggage to arrive, and of course, they'd lost it.
Yeah.
So there was no way for me to, like, contact this guy. Like, I was in the airport forever lodging this, like, lost ticket thing. So I go to this guy's house. It's the first time I've really met him and his wife. And I don't know, like, I think I met him briefly for lunch. And, you know, I go to sleep. I wake up the next morning and I have no clothes. This is day number 3. And I said to his wife, I was like, "You don't happen to have a t-shirt, do you? Like, I've been in these clothes for like 3 days." And she says, "Oh, I totally do." And so she gives me a t-shirt. And then she's like, "You probably need some pants too, right?" And I was like, "Yes." And she was like, "And some underwear?" And I was like, "Yes." So anyway, I'm like, I have a shower. I put all this stuff, you know, I'm putting this stuff on. I'm putting the underwear on. I look down. I'm like, something's not right. And there's like blood all in between my legs and on her underwear because I just started my period. At which point I just like burst into tears, like gave her underwear back. I don't know why I did that. Just, like, so horrified.
That's awesome.
Nothing to do with art, but geez,
right.
That was a bad trip.
That's the life of the traveling art critic.
Yeah,
that's brilliant.
Not all glamour.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Patty, this has been great. Thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for calling.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much again to Patty Johnson, especially for that story. That was good, right? Reminds me actually of a podcast I used to listen to quite a bit called Risk. Something like, their theme was something like true stories you never thought you'd dare to share. And Patty did not have any qualms about sharing that. So thank you, Patty, for that and for coming on the show. The website again is theconversationpod.com. You can support the show, of course, a number of ways. Donations, the first and foremost, appreciated. The donations have been a little on the thin side. I have given some thanks to some people, and I will thank you on the podcast. If you are able to donate, you can do that through the PayPal button on the website. Of course, you can support the show through social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We now have an Instagram account, so go check that out and follow us, please. And by the way, if you want to be friends with me on Facebook, I'm delighted, but if you found me through this show, please become a fan on Facebook first and then ask me to be a friend. Just a heads up, you know, no big deal. Oh, and if you have any feedback, anything you want to share, the new version of the website, which is going to be ready soon, we're going to sort of reintroduce the Don't Call Us segment of the show, which allows you to both publicly or anonymously share some of your stories, art world or tangentially art world related. So keep that in mind, think about some stories and get ready to share them. Thank you very much again for being here, and I will talk to you soon.